DW Deutsche Welle. World in Progress.
Hello and welcome to World in Progress. I'm Sarah Steffen in Bonn, Germany. Coming up on the show, we'll go to Zanzibar's recovering addicts in a so-called sober house.
Heroin is very good test, but it is very bad. You are going down. At the end, you'll find you don't have even, a sentence like this you don't have.
And we'll hear about the struggle of ending female genital mutilation from someone who was cut when she was a little girl and now works against it.
I've had a lot of conversations with my parents now. I wonder how much of that was family pressure from the women in the family that I should have it done. And it was something you don't question others in the family either.
Stay with us for these stories and much, much more. To many, Zanzibar's sandy beaches and crystal-clear waters seem like a picture-perfect paradise. Yet behind the confines of the chic hotel bars and pools, a growing number of locals are going through a heroin-induced hell, and it's one that's cheap to come by. Naomi Conrad and Michelle Hartleb went to one of Zanzibar's so-called sober houses, which attempt to wean the small East African island's population of the lethal drug.
As the car leaves the bustling centre of Zanzibar's capital, Stone Town, the road quickly peters out. Soon, it's no more than a dusty, bumpy track, lined by small shops and beauty salons, which give way to the gated homes of the East African island's middle class. A path leads to a house, much like the others surrounding it, but for the bright yellow fence with huge blue letters which spell out Recovery House. It's here to this nondescript house that Zanzibar's most desperate come to seek help to overcome the heroin-induced hell. The manager, a polite, softly spoken man, carefully locks the metal gate behind him before leading the way inside the dimly lit Spartan house where addicts sleep five to a room on metal bunk beds. Inside, handwritten faded posters extol the addicts to follow the 12 steps of Addicts Anonymous. Another one chimes, day by day and easy does it. Below, a ghostly thin man is sprawled on a mattress, his limbs twisted unnaturally by his seemingly lifeless body. It's hard to tell whether he's even breathing.
It is very painful. Yeah. He slept over there. So the first day, it was the same, when I come here, it was the same like this guy has slept, over there.
Hakim smiles ruefully. He came to the privately run clinic 18 days ago and he remembers the brutal, relentless pain that seared through his body after he went cold turkey on his first day. He's haggard, his Hawaiian print shirt hangs loosely from his body, his faded, rolled-up jeans show his thin legs covered in scars and bruises. He was 23 when a friend first introduced him to heroin, and almost three decades later, he still recalls his first high.
Heroin is very good test, but it is very bad. You feel, your dream, you'll be becoming a very rich people, yeah? But you're not. You are going down. At the end, you'll find you don't have a sentence like this you don't have.
Hakim lost everything. He used to work as a tour guide, taking foreigners to Zanzibar's pristine beaches, spice plantations, and organising luxury safaris for them on mainland Tanzania. But eventually, he lost first his job to his addiction and soon his flat, and was forced to live rough on the streets after his family disowned him. For in predominantly Muslim Zanzibar, drug use is a taboo, and addicts are often shunned. Many end up on the street sharing the syringes. More than 40% of users are estimated to be infected with HIV.
I use nearly 20 to 23 of my friends So all of those friends, the best of my friends, they was exchanged and they used the injection. So then after I find, one by one passed away.
For in Zanzibar, heroin is endemic. Since the 1980s, East Africa, and in particular this small island, has been a major landing point for heroin shipped from Afghanistan and Pakistan to Africa via the Indian Ocean. And according to the UN, the amount of drugs arriving via Zanzibar seems to be increasing. It's easy to see why. The coastline is porous, and isolated inlets and remote beaches provide an ideal landing spot for traffickers. While much is shipped on to other regions, a lot is feeding into a burgeoning domestic market. After all, a joint of heroin, mixed with marijuana and tobacco, is cheap, roughly $1. It's hard to come by official figures. Some media reports claim that as many as 7% of the 1.3 million people who live on Zanzibar and neighbouring Pemba Island may be addicted to heroin.
I'm the legal officer of the commission. But at the same time, I'm heading the...
But the government contends that the figure is closer to 1% and points to a newly rolled out methadone program and public awareness campaign it initiated in schools. The sober houses are run privately, relying on donations from international and domestic donors. But despite these programs, one thing is for sure. Tiny, impoverished Zanzibar, where the average income is less than $1 a day, is struggling to fight the international cartels, Juma Abdul Rahman says. The smart, poised man with the confident air of a senior official heads the island's Commission for Drug Control.
Our agencies are working very hard. Criminals, they are well prepared when they are doing these dirty jobs. Ships they are using are very strong ships. They are well equipped. I don't want to say that, but they have big ships more than ours. It's very tough to deal with them. And you cannot just deal with them alone. You have to be assisted by others who are well equipped.
Zanzibar, he says, desperately needs international help, be it from the US or European countries.
At the end, the effect of drugs is affecting the country itself. It's affecting everything. Because even the business, the war on drugs is not an easy war.
You see, this is the mattress.
Back in the recovery house, Hakim is fighting his own personal war. He's desperate to stay clean, he says, and rebuild his life from scratch. He smiles ruefully.
When I finish, I mean to become a clean, I will find a new girlfriend. I find my new home. I find my new car. Anything's... I hope and I wish.
He has a chance, even though it's a slim one. More than 50% of addicts relapse, according to the rehabilitation center's manager. But compared to many, he's lucky. Unable to pay the modest fee to attend the sober house, so many others are left to fend for themselves. For DW, I'm Naomi Conrad on Zanzibar.
This week on Monday marked International Day of Zero Tolerance Against Female Genital Mutilation, or female genital cutting as it's also called. It's estimated that more than 200 million women and girls have been cut worldwide, according to the United Nations. And more women are speaking out to end the practice, as they do here in a video produced by Love Matters India.
A cut that pierced my life. A small nick. Just a piece of skin, they say. No more, no less. How does it change anything?
It changed everything for my loved ones and me.
It changed my loved ones for me.
Female genital cutting. 200 million women have undergone this worldwide.
One of the women featured in this video is 34-year-old Maria Taher, who co-founded the NGO SEO. Taher was born in the US to parents from India. When she was 7, her parents took her on a trip to visit relatives in India, where she had a piece of clitoral hood removed. Taher is now advocating against the practice of FGM. She's also tracked down other women who are cut. When we spoke, she began explaining why ending FGM is particularly important to her.
It was something that I really wanted to shed light on because I had undergone it myself as a 7-year-old. I was born in the United States and then and taken back to India, not for the purpose, sole purpose of having this done. We used to go back on vacation every other year to visit relatives, but the summer when I was 7, I also had this procedure done. So I always knew that it happened, and a lot of my family members had it done. Family members had it done in the United States as well. And
actually on American soil then?
Yes, on American soil. So I was always familiar with it. Technically, though, when it happened to me, it was not illegal in the United States at that time. The federal law passed 6 or 7 years after it happened to me. The more I did research, I also recognized there was a lack of awareness that it was happening to communities outside of the African continent or African ethnic communities. So I never found much out there in terms of research about women like me. So I really wanted to shed light that this is a complicated form of violence as well, because it's oftentimes confused with love and the idea that this is what you do to ensure that a woman grows up to be a morally sound person. It's controlling your sexuality, but it's so conflicted with these other ideas and thoughts. It was a form of violence that is oftentimes continued on women by women, so mothers to daughters, or other female relatives to other female relatives. And so oftentimes men have been left out. That's shifting too.
You mentioned that it's violence done by women, done to other women. And I always wondered, especially the mothers and aunts who've undergone it themselves, why would they do this to their daughters? Is it really just for the sake of tradition?
I think people underestimate the idea of tradition, how powerful a force it is. It's something that's considered a social norm. So it's something that's considered, if you don't get it done, you are not doing the best you can for your child. And it has been convoluted and construed in a way that it is a form of taking care of your child in a way. Like all of the taboos that in many cultures you see around menstruation too, and thoughts that you might be unclean or something. And these are old traditions, old ideas, or harmful practices that are steeped into the culture now. And that those are social norms, but those are things you have to change too.
I also read that sometimes, even though the parents are against the practice, that grandparents then take matters into their own hands. I think the parents went away to another village, and so the daughters were left in the care of the grandparents. And then, well, first thing when the parents were away was that the grandmother took the girls to get the procedure done.
We've heard stories like that too, where it might have been somebody's aunt that took them or another female relative that took them. So there is a lot of social pressure that happens as well. So the parents might not want it to continue. And I think for particularly for communities that are very close-knit, and the community I was raised in is considered a very close-knit community, where you're afraid of being socially ostracized. And there's a lot of fear that if you don't have this done, or if you go against the wishes of perhaps religious leaders or other members, that you risk that too, that social exclusion.
That's Maria Taher speaking about the practice of female genital mutilation or cutting here on DW's World in Progress. We'll hear more from her when we return. We're still here with Maria Taher talking about the practice of FGM. I asked her about the link between cutting and religion.
The Daliboras are a Muslim community, and so the Quran does not say anything about this. And that has been heavily stated by many Islamic scholars that this is not in the Quran. But the Daliboras also have some other religious texts that they follow. And there are some texts that do claim that you must continue this. And I know in the last year, the religious heads of this particular community came out saying that it is a practice in our holy books, and so that we must continue it. Interestingly, though, the shift to religion or stating religion as the primary reason to continue this was something that kind of changed in the last year. Because when I was doing my thesis, and what I heard a lot of other people say previously, too, is they always were told that it was done to control sexuality. But now we're hearing sort of the reasoning change that it's actually done for hygiene. And that's the religious reason for why you do it. There's no proof at all that it has any health benefits. Yet people still cling to the idea that it does. A lot of times you will hear people say that people that are for it or are trying to justify the continuation of it say that, oh, those are more severe forms that happen, you know, in Africa. Those are the ones that are mutilation and should not continue. But what we're doing is safe, particularly if it's been done in a health setting, which is a trend that we're seeing occurring as well. And in some countries, like in Indonesia, I know in Singapore, there it is medicalized. And so health professionals are doing it much more. It's amazing what people do to justify a tradition, too, to try to make it okay in their mind that this is something that we can continue, that we're not hurting anybody.
Did your parents prepare you for the trip? Did they tell you what was coming, or was it a total surprise?
I honestly don't remember. I have few memories of it happening. And I was 7, too. And I don't know if part of it is I just blocked it out or part of it is because I was young and I can't remember. All I remember really is that I remember the actual event, like going to the building. I remember going upstairs. I remember being put on the floor. I remember being cut. I remember my mom comforting me too. And I remember the ladies afterwards actually comforting me as well and giving me a soda to drink. The day it happened, I remember crying because it hurt, but I don't really remember much afterwards. I had been taught that it was something celebratory. Even when my sister had it done, I thought it was something that was celebratory, and I never even thought to question it until high school when I think a friend of mine mentioned the actual word female genital mutilation.
Have you ever, when you started to become aware of this topic, have you ever discussed with your parents why they opted for FGM or cutting when you were a little girl?
I have. I mean, the more I started doing research and the more I've done work on this, I've had a lot of conversations with my parents now. It was really, it's tradition. It boils down to it. It was what they were expected to do. My mom was the one who, she told me that she was afraid of seeing me in pain, and my aunt came along because she was afraid of that. And so I feel like, I wonder how much of that was family pressure from the women in the family that I should have it done. And it was something you don't question others in the family either. We've had conversations, and it's something that I think people are changing their ideas and thoughts. You're seeing that social change happening. Social change doesn't happen overnight, but you're starting to see the questions. You're starting to see the conversations coming out. Like, we're trying to build a critical mass of people, right? To show that this is something that we can choose not to continue. Because I think a lot of times people don't realize that option even exists, that you can choose not to continue it. And so being able to show that there are people that have decided that is so impactful.
And that was Maria Taher speaking to me about female genital mutilation or cutting and how to end it. And we continue with the story that we briefly touched upon during the interview, the taboo of menstruation. For girls in industrialized first world countries, that's no longer a big deal. But in South Africa, for instance, like in most African countries, menstruation is not only a social taboo, but it can also have a massive negative impact on the lives of millions of girls. A female entrepreneur came up with a solution. Mina, the menstruation cup. Kerstin Welter has more.
Mina is a cup, a menstrual cup. Made of silicone, it looks like a miniature see-through beanie hat. It's about 5 centimeters in size, and it's supposed to last for 5 to 10 years. Unlike pads or tampons, it is reusable, and the cost of 200 rand, round about 13 euro, is minimal compared to the cost of pads and tampons, which would cost almost 3 euro per month. The Mina cup is handed out to schoolgirls for free, as Sakira Mohammed explains. She's the founder of the Mina project, and has had the cup designed specifically for young girls' bodies. Zakira is a social entrepreneur with a strong vision.
You know, I didn't come from a wealthy family. And my dad, he always told me I could be anyone I want to. And my circumstances don't define who I become. And that's why when I took on this project, that's what I wanted to do for these girls. I wanted to say to them, we believe in you. You can come out of this situation. Your life is about getting an education and getting a job and doing what you want to do.
Being poor and having your period often means withdrawing from school so as not to be exposed. And there is the issue of safety. The toilets might be decrepit or far away from the school building, and girls on their own are an easy prey for criminals. By staying at home, some girls miss up to 50 days of school, which sets in motion a whole cascade of negative effects.
When they're sitting at home, they become idle. They get involved in the wrong things, and they need ways to, whether it's buying sanitary towels or buying cosmetics, we are girls. We want nice things. So you'll find they'll start getting involved with older men just for money. Then the next thing, they're pregnant, and then he goes off to someone else, another young girl. And then they're infected sometimes with diseases and things like that. And that's the cycle of poverty. You'll never get out of it.
Zakira Mohammed is sure about it. The MENA Cup can prevent all of this happening. With her business partner, Dr. Mashadi Mutlana, they have given the product not only a name, but a character too, to make it playful and more appealing to the girls. Mashadi Mutlana proudly shows the MENA.
So this is a container which is branded MENA with the character MENA. And we've got this beautiful packaging. It's a satin pouch. So in order to use it, you fold it. It's about the size of a mini tampon. Once inside, it opens up to collect the menstrual fluid, and it requires very little changing, maybe 8 to 12 hours, depending on the flow. We use it, we love our product, and from the feedback we've gotten, the girls that are using MENA see MENA as their friend.
But before that friendship can form, there's quite a bit of convincing to do. Most of the girls who were presented a MENA cup are at first extremely doubtful, like Makufane.
A cup, I thought it was a cup, it was like drinking coffee. I was like, no, I ain't gonna use that, I'm not going to use that. No, cups are for drinking, not for using that. And then the facilitator kind of like talked to me, and then I understood it at the end. And I enjoy using it.
My name is Kelly.
Yeah.
I'm from Marion High.
Yeah.
That's on the Cape Flats.
Oh, yeah.
And sometimes I can't do sport after school.
Kelly Eve Kirkman is one of the facilitators introducing the MENA Cup in rural schools. She's a trained performer and uses her skills to approach the girls who are often insecure and intimidated by talking about menstruation. Kelly Eve and her two colleagues spent many hours with the girls explaining everything about the period and empowering them to be self-confident when dealing with it.
Girls think that their period is something disgusting and it's so smelly and stinky. And we're like, actually, when you have the MENA and you pull out your cup, you realize it doesn't. A pad or a tampon that's sitting and collecting sweat against your body all day, that is creating the smell. That's not your body.
The facilitators come back twice to each school to make sure all questions are answered and everybody's happy using the menstrual cup. Like Sintle, the 17-year-old who used not to go to school often because she could not afford sanitary products, has become a proud ambassador for the MENA Cup.
MENA Cup really changed my life because now I do believe in my dreams and I'm even so empowered to teach other young girls what I was being taught in this program. Yes, during break time, I call my group and sit around and talk about different issues we have in life.
That was Kerstin Welter reporting from South Africa. From one taboo to the next. In Morocco, being unmarried and pregnant is an extremely difficult situation to be in. Sex out of wedlock is taboo, considered a violation of family honor, and is even punishable by law. Young women who wind up pregnant are seen as quote-unquote damaged goods, and many are rejected by their families. One women's rights activist has been fighting for over 30 years to change the system. Dunja Sadaki went to meet her in the Moroccan capital Rabat, and her report is presented by Samantha Early.
Fatim Zahra wasn't even 20 years old when she fell pregnant to a childhood friend from her neighbourhood. She was in love and wanted to marry him. But as soon as he found out about the pregnancy, he didn't want anything to do with her. Who knows who the child belongs to, he'd said to her. In the end, she confided in her mother.
Il m'a dit rien, juste il me voit.
She didn't say anything to me. She just looked at me, cried, and then said, "Why have you done this to me?" Now she loves my baby very much, but she always says to me, "You did this to me." She tells me that again and again.
Her mother sent her to Aisha Echena. The 76-year-old women's rights activist is renowned throughout Morocco for her 30-year struggle to help unmarried mothers. Her NGO, called Women's Solidarity, provides a place for girls to stay. There, they get trained up in a profession over 3 years, a wage, a roof over their heads, and care for their children. Even when a mother and child are provided for, life is difficult, says Aisha Echena. It starts with the country's laws.
Article 446 says that a child born from fornication is considered a bastard and must remain a bastard, even if the paternity test is positive and the father recognizes the child as his own. And that is still the law today.
At school, university or work, anywhere a birth certificate has to be presented, it's clear who was born out of wedlock. These children face discrimination throughout their lives. Even if the father recognises his child, he has no obligation to pay child support or to help out with child care. Aisha Echena says this often leads to children living on the street, prostituting themselves, causing trouble, or in some cases, taking their own lives. Others, especially boys, develop a hatred for their mothers or women in general. It's a vicious circle, says Aisha Echena, but it's one that can be broken with prevention, for example. Proper sexual education is the key, she says, but it's practically non-existent in Moroccan schools. Aisha Echena's commitment to women's rights and education has made her a target of hatred and attacks, especially from Islamists who accuse her of wanting to promote prostitution. It's also won her supporters, though. In the streets of Casablanca, hardly anyone passes her without stopping for a chat. Women treat her like a revered grandmother, greeting her with heartfelt kisses. Her two phones ring incessantly. A new case, a new protege, new worries. She speaks to every one of them, she says. With leftists, with Islamists, people off the street. She even met with the king twice. Any success on that front? Not much, she admits.
The Moroccans have to change their mentality. The men need to understand that sexual freedom isn't just for them. Who are they having sex with? With a sister of a friend, with a neighbor, or whomever? And the women also have to change. There are doctors who specialize in surgically restoring the hymen. I was the first woman to talk openly about these kinds of problems, but I have a feeling that I'm speaking into the void.
Fatim Zahra, the young mother, has experienced these double standards firsthand. Her neighbours don't greet her. Instead, they throw hostile glances her way and verbally abuse her and her 10-month-old baby in the street. Her siblings don't visit, and her baby is a taboo subject when they talk on the phone. The young mother and her baby have no contact with the baby's father, she says. He refused to take a paternity test.
He's living his life, and that's not important to him. He's not interested in his child. He's free. He does what he wants. That's not fair. It's just not fair.
Fatim Zahra says she often feels alone, but every time she looks at her child, she feels strong.
Samantha Early with a report by Dunja Sadaki. And that wraps up this week's Wealth in Progress. If you'd like to listen to this or past episodes again, just go to dw.com/wealthinprogress or find us on iTunes or SoundCloud. Thanks very much for tuning in from all of us in the studio, Iliane Gilarducci and Florian Bohn. I'm Sarah Steffen, and this was Wealth in Progress. Bye for now.